Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man whose intelligence I have found to be extraordinary, especially in a part of the battle space of the war for the free world that is generally, well, poorly understood, if at all, is our first guest. He is Kevin Freeman, I'm proud to say, a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, specializing in economic warfare. He is the driving force behind globaleconomicwarfare.com and the author of two best-selling books, Game Plan and Secret Weapon. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
The president, of course, is traveling in Asia at the moment. He's on his way to China, where there is increasing evidence of what I think you have been warning about for a long time, namely that the president, the country, we in the free world, for that matter, are being subjected increasingly to unmistakable and indeed aggressive Chinese economic warfare. Talk a bit about what you think the president is going to be confronting when he gets to China and what he best be alive to in terms of what is actually going on there.
Well, there was a great article in Asia Times that titled, "Trump Must Tread Carefully with His Asian Bankers." The view of, from the Asian perspective, particularly China's perspective, of President Trump's come to visit is one who owes them a lot of money, and he better come hat in hand, and he better come willing to acknowledge that they hold debt and we owe them money. And that's their perspective, and that reinforces this idea we can pull the rug out from under the dollar anytime we want to, so you better give us what we want, you better act appropriately, bow properly.
And does this mask some of their own difficulties internally, certainly financial, if not political at the moment? Is this a deflection or spin, if you will, designed to increase their leverage on Trump? Or is it certainly unmistakably true that they are our banker? How does that sort, do you think?
Well, if you put all the cards on the table, their economic strength is not nearly as great as it was a few years ago. A lot of that, as Gordon Chang has pointed out, was smoke and mirrors anyway, with a massive buildup of debt. Their government is not in any better shape than we are. In fact, if you were being honest, they're actually in worse shape. They've manufactured their economic activity. Our economic activity is real. Our economic activity is growing and robust. Theirs is very debt-laden at the state and corporate levels, and so they are potentially in great economic problem. One difference, we have the reserve currency of the world, which allows us to sustain through difficult times and lots of debt. They do not, and I think that's their path, is they want to take away that reserve currency status from us and apply it to themselves.
Yeah, and that would hurt us, obviously, very much. It would also presumably enable them to weather these kinds of debt crises rather better. And Kevin, let's talk about the Chinese effort to displace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world in the context of something you've been forecasting now for some time, and the president has engaged through a tweet to express his enthusiasm for. Rather different, I think, than the feeling you and I have about it. But talk a little bit about the Saudi Aramco initial public offering, where it stands now. Is it going to come to the United States, as President Trump has encouraged the Saudi king to do? Is it going to be bought up by the Chinese? Is it going to be an engine for this kind of basic switch out, switcheroo, I guess you'd call it, of the reserve currency of the world?
Well, and the reason you've got to go back to the history of the dollar as reserve currency, one of the great pillars of strength underneath it is the fact that all oil is traded in U.S. dollars. That's an agreement that we had with the Saudis decades ago, a half century ago, and where they agreed that we would buy their oil at whatever price, and they would put the money back into U.S. Treasury bonds and created what's known as the petrodollar. The Chinese recognize that that's a problem. Saudi Arabia is desperately in trouble for capital because they started an oil war that they couldn't finish against the United States. They lowered prices, hoping to destroy our fracking industry, something we talked about several years ago. They failed. Our fracking industry responded with improved technology and resilience. And we found that we could produce oil cheaper than the Saudis could afford to sell it because of their budgetary requirements. So they're desperately in need of money, and they're offering now 5% potentially of their Saudi Aramco company, their state-owned oil company, and they want to offer it in an initial public offering in New York, and they want us to give $100 billion for 5% ownership. And there's reason that we shouldn't do that. The president is saying we should do that, but the threat is if you don't give us this money, we'll turn to the Chinese, and the Chinese will immediately insist that oil no longer be traded in U.S. dollars. It needs to be traded either, you know, presumably in Chinese yuan.
So to the extent that the Saudis are putting up for sale a portion, a very small portion, but nonetheless a portion of this vast enterprise of theirs, largely obtained by nationalizing investments by the United States and Brits, as I recall. But they are now going to sell some of that to somebody. Could the Chinese, Kevin Freeman, reasonably expect through that purchase, if they were to make a substantial portion of that purchase, a platform for engaging the Saudis in this kind of swap out, denominating the Saudi oil production and presumably that of others as well in the renminbi rather than the dollar?
Well, there are two things I know that are true. One is the Chinese have told them that that's what they would like to do. And two, the Saudis have told us that that is something that they might have to do if they took the money from China. And so it's become almost a blackmail type threat. Unless you do this IPO, unless you give us American dollars, that's likely to happen. And my problem with that is multifold. But one of the problems that I have is they already said, well, after we sell the first 5%, we'll go sell a second 5%. So the blackmail, so to speak, would emerge. You know, we give them $100 billion of our money, and then they come back and say, oh, we're selling another 5%. This 5% is going to China, and we're still going to swap out the currency oil is traded in.
Yeah. I think one of the points that has been made by friends of ours is that when Prince Salman, Mohammed bin Salman, came to Washington to meet Donald Trump earlier this year, his father, King Salman, was in Beijing at exactly the same moment. And one wonders whether this isn't part of a kind of bait and switch by the Saudis and the Chinese. Let me turn lastly to get your thoughts, Kevin Freeman, author of Game Plan and Secret Weapon. Your take on what is happening inside the kingdom. The Wall Street Journal today is reporting that there, you know, are repercussions in the global economy as a result of uncertainties in Saudi Arabia, as a result of the arrests there and the consolidation of power by the Crown Prince. How do you see that, Kevin?
Well, it's interesting. I've talked to a number of people, and I've gotten two opposing views, and they're exactly opposite, but they're tied to the same issue. One group says that there was a group in Saudi Arabia that was opposed to replacing the dollar and wanted to side with the Chinese, and that group had to be rounded up and arrested and taken out of the picture. The other side says that there was that those that were opposed to switching off of the dollar needed to be rounded up. So one side was saying we've got to be pro-American. The other side was saying we got to be pro-China. But there's a question is
which one won?
Exactly.
Interesting. Interesting insight as always. Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that for today. So much more to talk with you about. We look forward to doing so in our regular visits next week. And thank you for your time today and the great work you do, among other places, at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Check it out, folks. Next up, we will be speaking with Claudia Rosette. We'll get her take on the president's travels, including the focus on North Korea. Right after this, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Claudia Rosette, a fabulous investigative reporter, a prize-winning journalist, editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal in days gone by. These days, a blogger par excellence with the Rosette Report at PJ Media. She is also a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum and a fabulous and highly regarded contributor to our program. Thank you so much, Claudia, for doing that and for being with us. Among other things, you have been posted overseas in your long and distinguished career in Moscow. And I wanted to just say this is, of course, the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the denouement of the Communist Revolution, the Bolshevik takeover of what became the Soviet Union. What are your thoughts on the, well, not just that event, but what flowed from it even to our own time?
Well, Frank, Vince, good to be here. The 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, I think, was the single most catastrophic event of the modern world. It has despoiled half the planet in the last century. It did, the Communist Revolution was something that brought to the fore in a huge, troubled nation, the most ruinous ideology of the 20th century. It was spectacularly horrible. We don't know the precise number, put it well north of 100 million died as a result in both in Russia, in China when it went communist, in Cambodia, in the war in Vietnam, in the ruin that was inflicted on Eastern Europe. We live with it to this day, including the events that were set in motion when the Soviets went into Afghanistan. The, as we then called them, Mujahideen, and now call them jihadis, were consolidated against them. This rolled on to this day. It was a horrific totalitarian ideology, and that was 100 years ago today.
It still manifests itself, doesn't it, Claudia? We're never quite sure exactly what Vladimir Putin's ideological moorings may be, but his sort of appetite for totalitarianism certainly smacks of what he used to do for the KGB. And then there's Xi Jinping in China, who is very publicly planning to turn back the clock to the Mao period. And of course, the Kim dynasty under Kim Jong-un at the moment in North Korea, these people are still hard at it and threatening us more and more by the day, in a manner very, very much like communism and its heyday.
Yeah, well, what communism did was destroy all normal institutions of society, government, all the things that sort of had some promise of evolving into freer societies were just destroyed. And out of this, it's very fertile ground for continuing dictatorship. You had the rise of Putin in Russia. You've got now this reconsolidation of the Communist Party power in China under Xi Jinping. And in North Korea, of course, Stalin installed the grandfather of the current dictator, installed Kim Il-sung after World War II when the peninsula was divided.
Set him loose on the Korean War as well, lest we forget.
That's right, which gave us, in 1950, the surprise invasion by the North of the South, which took 3 years and incredible carnage to beat back to the DMZ where they are today.
Well, speaking of which, Claudia, let's turn to today, because while the president is evidently not going to spend any time on the DMZ, he has been elsewhere in South Korea, and he's headed to China as part of his very extended tour of Asia. I wonder what you made of his remarks in South Korea about North Korea, what's going on there. And also, you've written recently at PJ Media about the fact that the obvious, most basic thing that one would think an administration that wanted to punish the North Koreans would do would be to put them back on the state sponsor of terrorism list, and yet that isn't happening. Talk about that as well, if you would.
Yeah, that's so dead obvious. North Korea was taken off the list. The U.S. State Department keeps a list of state sponsors of terrorism, which in this era of global terrorism has troublingly shrunk to just three countries, Iran, Sudan, and Syria. North Korea was on the list from 1988 to 2008. They were put on after blowing up in 1987 a South Korean airliner over the Andaman Sea, killing all 115 people aboard. In 2008, President Bush was trying desperately to preserve an intrinsically rotten nuclear deal with North Korea, struck in 2007. And in sort of a desperate bid to give them concessions they wanted, took them off the list of terror sponsoring states. He should never have done it. The deal fell apart anyway. And President Obama should have immediately put them back on when he came into office. He did not for 8 years.
The strategic patience was what he was doing instead, of course.
Precisely. And this stands both as, for North Korea, it's this nice concession that they wanted and got and has never been taken back, even though it'd be very easy for the U.S. to do.
And you specifically have pointed out that, you know, the use of chemical weapon against a national of North Korea and Malaysia, related that to the Kim dynasty, would you think qualify as a terrorist act, would it not?
Yeah, there's so many things that would qualify. The State Department is sort of studying this as if it were some baffling philosophical question, and they're looking at the statutes, you know, the use of VX nerve agent in a Malaysian commercial airport to assassinate the half-brother of the dictator of North Korea is a terrorist act, as I see it. They were going to assassinate Kim Jong-un's brother. There are ways to do it less terrorizing to the world than displaying in an airport that they are willing to use VX nerve agent on somebody. But there are also the abductees from Japan, never fully accounted for to this day. That's terrorism, when people are simply kidnapped and taken to be trained as agents. Also, one of the potential criteria, there's a lot of maneuvering room for the administration in this, is that they're manufacturing weapons of mass destruction that could potentially be acquired by terrorists. Well, that applies to North Korea in spades. They should simply put them back on the list of terrorist sponsoring states. There is no good reason not to.
So let me turn then to China, Claudia Rosette. We're, again, going to watch something of a dance take place there, partly surrounding President Trump's efforts, which seem to have been disappointed, to be sure, in the past, but are nonetheless continuing to enlist the Chinese as our helpmates in contending with this North Korean threat. What would you recommend, Claudia, again, having spent a lot of time in Hong Kong as part of the Wall Street Journal East Asia editorial team? What would you have him say to the Chinese at a moment like this?
I would have him be very, very skeptical that China is going to help in any enduring way on this front. You know, there's a lot of discussion about how he should pressure China to help us solve North Korea. I don't think China has any interest in helping us solve North Korea. And whatever deal they might cut under pressure today, they can start to back away from tomorrow. That's the problem. This is a dynamic process. It's not a one-off solution. And the thing that he really needs to be doing, I don't know that this could be done in public, but the important thing is I'm telling you the way the real world works. Whether it will happen this way is a different question. But the only answer, the only real solution in North Korea is an end to the Kim Jong-un regime. That's the only thing that will work. And for that, it's unlikely that China will actually help. What needs to be discussed is precisely how far we will tolerate China going if we push North Korea to the point of collapse.
which has to be done, alas, if they do not take him out, I think. Claudia, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as always. And it's a bitter anniversary, I think, for all of us who love freedom. But thank you for helping us reflect on it and take stock of its abiding and bitter, bitter legacy. Thank you so much. Talk to you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Hans von Spakovsky about, well, among other things, cover-ups to protect the Clintons. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Hans von Spakovsky, a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to, in particular, the public policy challenges that we're facing in, well, broadly speaking, the judicial arena. He is these days a senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He has worked in government, however, in senior positions in the Justice Department, among other things. He is also currently serving on the President's Commission on Electoral Integrity and rendering a very important and continuing public service in that role, as well as by visiting with us from time to time. Hans, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, thanks for having me.
Well, you've done some really important writing recently that caught my eye, in particular in connection with this scandal that has gotten a lot more attention lately, I think it's fair to say, but not nearly what it deserves, namely the Clinton team's connivances, collusion, I guess is the operative word these days, with the Russians in connection with this so-called Uranium One transaction. Now, you having served in the Justice Department and followed closely its activities for years, I'm wondering, what did Eric Holder know about the FBI's investigations into all of that? And when did he know it? Do you have a sense of that?
Sure. Well, we should explain. In 2010, the federal government, so the Obama administration, approved the purchase by the Russians, the Russian government essentially, of the Uranium One mining company that gave them control of about 20% of U.S. Uranium production. Now, the problem is this was approved in 2010 by a government committee. This is a federal committee. It has representatives from about 14 different federal agencies, including Hillary Clinton as head of the State Department at the time, and Eric Holder, head of the Attorney General, as the Attorney General, head of the Justice Department. The problem with the approval of this was that in 2009, the FBI under Bob Mueller was approached by a U.S. businessman in the uranium industry who said, I'm being told by these Russians I have to give them a kickback in order to do business with them. And so they set up this whole undercover operation with the informant. And it turned out that this Russian company, which is controlled by the Russian government, had this extensive kickback and bribery scheme that it was using to try to get a foothold in the American uranium industry. Now, you would think they knew about this in 2009. You know, that's a year before this government committee.
This is the so-called Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, better known as CFIUS, right?
Right. Has to approve this deal. However, Eric Holder and Bob Mueller didn't inform the committee about this undercover operation in which they had solid proof of the bribery and kickback scheme. Not only that, but the informant also provided them with extensive information that Russian officials interested in this deal were giving tens of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation in an obvious attempt to get in good with Hillary Clinton.
Let me just ask you, Hans von Spakovsky, you've spent time, as I say, in the senior reaches of the Justice Department. There's no question that Bob Mueller, as the director of the FBI, would have been very intimately familiar with what information the FBI had developed in terms of all of this misconduct, it appears, on the part of the Russians and their cutouts and the Clintonistas. Is there a question in your mind that Eric Holder as the direct report of Bob Mueller, would have been oblivious to this information? Or did he know and do nothing with it when this vote was being done in CFIUS?
Either he knew about it and didn't bother to say anything, or he and his staff are complete and total incompetence to not know about this. You know, you've got a major sale being proposed by a Russian company that's wholly controlled by the Russian government. The most basic question you would ask is of your FBI director is, what do you know about this company? What's the background of this company? Is it a totally legitimate company or not? And Bob Mueller obviously would know about.
And presumably would have done his due responsibility, which is informing his boss thereof as well. Let me ask you then, Rob Rosenstein is another player in the current so-called scandal involving allegations that Donald Trump or his campaign were similarly colluding with the Russians to what we've just been discussing, Hans. You've indicated in a recent analysis that it sure looks as though what's happened here, I guess as a result of his involvement as well as that of Mueller and presumably Holder, and of course Hillary Clinton, was a political operation, a decision that was effectively designed to cover up what went down. Is that right?
Yeah, well, what happened is kind of odd. The major Russian government official involved in this wasn't indicted until 2014. That means the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Maryland allowed this undercover operation, which with bribery and kickbacks, to go on for 5 years. I can't believe. And then they only charged this Russian official with a single count of money laundering, not for paying multiple bribes or soliciting multiple kickbacks, and no mention was made in the indictment whatsoever of all the additional payments that had been made to the Clinton Foundation. The other weird thing about it was that not only were all the charges reduced from what they could have been, but there was a non-disclosure agreement placed on the FBI informant so that he couldn't publicly say anything about this undercover operation. I've never heard of that with an informant.
Yeah, it stinks is the short layman's way of describing, I think, what you've just very eloquently laid out before us.
We should mention that not only was this committee not told about this, but neither the House nor the U.S. Senate intelligence committees were ever briefed about this.
So it really does smack of a cover-up and of a high political order at that. I hope that there will be a serious investigation, presumably by somebody other than Rod Rosenstein or Bob Mueller, or involving in any way, shape, or form this other character who is a player in this current drama, of course, and that is Jim Comey, the former director of the FBI who succeeded Bob Mueller in that job. You've written recently, Hans von Spakovsky, about Comey and his activities along this sort of saga, this trail of alleged collusion with the Russians by the Trump team. But one of the things that's top of the fold in the Washington Times front page today and other papers is that Comey evidently initially said that what Hillary Clinton was doing in another of her scandals, namely her malfeasant mishandling of this body of emails, was, quote, grossly negligent, unquote, something that he then toned down to just being extremely careless. What's going on there, as you see it, Hans?
Well, what he was doing was trying to give him an out for not charging her with a violation of the law, because gross negligence is the standard under the applicable federal law for the mishandling of classified data. And if he had maintained that assessment, then he couldn't in any way not have charged her. So instead, he comes forward and says, oh, it's not gross negligence. It's just, extremely careless behavior.
But the reporting suggests that they had in his initial drafts, he still wasn't going to prosecute her. And are you just saying that would have been a sticky wicket for him to try to pull?
Yeah, it would have been harder for him to excuse what he's doing. But it's pretty clear that the memos, the early memos that were drafted for him saying they weren't going to charge her, they were done months before. months before the investigation was even completed.
Alice in Wonderland, verdict first, trial after.
Right.
So it's just scandalous. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing at the Heritage Foundation these days, Hans von Spakovsky, to help clarify for us mere mortals what on earth this is all about, and to, again, hopefully ensure that people who need to be are held accountable. I hope you come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we'll talk with Philip Haney, a veteran of the Department of Homeland Security, about that dysfunctional agency and what it's going to take to ensure it does the job we must have it. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Philip Haney, a retired Department of Homeland Security officer. He served with great distinction in the Customs and Border Protection Bureau from the founding, in fact, of the Department of Homeland Security. He had some rather tough experiences with it over the years because of some of the serious shortcomings in that department and its management, particularly under the Obama administration. These are documented in a superb book, a bestseller, in fact, that he wrote with Art Moore, entitled See Something, Say Nothing: A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad. Philip Haney, welcome back. It's so great to have a chance to visit with you.
Very glad to be here, friend. Thank you.
Well, let's start with what has been going on in the department in which you served for some 13 years, as I recall. It has been described as the most dysfunctional agency in the United States government. It is about to get a new secretary. The secretary of the Department of Homeland Security's designate is a woman by the name of Kirstjen Nielsen. Let's talk a little from your firsthand experience, Phil, with how that department is functioning when it comes to things like clarity about the nature of the enemy we're facing. You call it submission to jihad and border security and immigration enforcement, sanctuary cities, and the like.
Sure. If I had an opportunity to address a question to Ms. Nielsen, I'd like to ask her how she intends to address and or remedy the chronic problem of low morale within the three main branches of the Department of Homeland Security. And those three main branches are Customs and Border Protection, my former agency, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, but now called HSI, and the Border Patrol. Because primarily during the Obama administration, all three of us, the members of those three agencies, were handcuffed and blindfolded. Each one of us received directives that made it virtually impossible to do our job. And because of that, morale, as you mentioned, was chronically low for year after year after year. And so that would be a good first step for any new DHS secretary, would be to address that. And I don't think the problem is that hard to solve. Simply let the guys do their jobs.
And Phil Haney, the blindfolding, as you've called it, the see something, say nothing phenomenon, has that ended under the Trump administration? Is there not only a new president in office, but a new approach to understanding the enemy and, you know, developing strategies for countering them, not only abroad, but here in the homeland as well?
Yes, actually. I'm pleased to say that there are two very, very helpful, hopeful indicators that were actually signed by previous Secretary Kelly before he became Chief of Staff. The headers are implementing the President's Border Security and Immigration Enforcement Improvement Policies. Those are directives from February 20th, 2017, and a companion directive is enforcement of the immigration laws to serve the national interest. Two memos put out by DHS, signed by Secretary Kelly on the 20th of February, that are the most hopeful law enforcement-based documents that I'd seen come out of the agency in practically the entire time that I served since its inception.
Now, neither of those would address an area that I know you've also been very concerned about, at least not explicitly. Correct me if I'm wrong about that, Phil Haney. And that is this so-called Countering Violent Extremism program that was a very prominent fixture in the Obama administration writ large, but specifically within your old agency, the Department of Homeland Security. Is that now over the side, or has it been fundamentally transformed, as the president used to say?
Well, it's definitely been backburnered on the shelf. And if the implementation of these two directives from Secretary Kelly are followed through, which I've heard is actually happening, then by default, CVE will fade away because they're incompatible, meaning law enforcement-based approach to counterterrorism and protecting our country from threat is going to override or supersede this civil rights and civil liberties-based policy that diminished the emphasis on law enforcement. The Obama administration's view was, we'll treat these people, we'll emphasize their civil rights and civil liberties, which is okay, civil rights, civil liberties is good, but not at the expense of our national security.
And Phil, you document chillingly, really, in See Something, Say Nothing, the extent to which that sort of trumping of national security concerns actually imbued certain people with rights that they weren't actually entitled to. Is it not just that some had constitutional rights, it's that people were, notably people coming here from overseas who had no right to be here and who were not entitled to constitutional protections, were nonetheless being brought in and set up for what seems, I think, unmistakably to be harmful activity against our country. Talk a little bit about that against the backdrop of what Ms. Kirstjen Nielsen is going to be facing and what we must expect of her if she is, in fact, confirmed.
Great question, because paragraph G of one of the two memos, of a six-page memo, specifically addresses the Privacy Rights Act and says that no longer will privacy rights be extended to foreign nationals or lawful permanent residents, what we know of as green card holders. And in that one short sentence, it disarms the whole policy of the previous administration. That is exactly what the previous administration was doing, is extending privacy rights and civil liberties to foreign nationals. That's why I got in so much trouble. That's why they shut the cases that I worked on between the Muslim Brotherhood and the other big case that I worked on, the Tablighi Jamaat case related to the San Bernardino shooting, was because they said we were violating the civil rights and civil liberties of foreign nationals. So in that one paragraph of that memo, that is a major realization by then Secretary Kelly and his team.
So it falls to the new secretary, whoever that may be, if not Ms. Nielsen, somebody else, to ensure that that language, indeed these two memos, are faithfully executed. And Phil Haney, just very quickly, because Tablighi Jamaat is an organization that is probably unknown to the vast majority of people, even in our sophisticated listening audience, would you just say a word about that group and why it is of such concern that it was given, essentially, this kid glove treatment by the previous administration, including the destruction of some of the information that you had compiled to help monitor their activities?
Well, Tablighi Jamaat is one of the fingers on the hand of a large branch of Islam out of the Indian subcontinent under what is known as the Deobandi movement from a city in north central India. Tablighi Jamaat, another group we've heard of, is Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is the one that did the Mumbai massacre. And another one that's affiliated that we've all heard of is Taliban. All of these individuals are part of the Deobandi branch of Islam, which is supported by the largesse of Saudi Arabia and the madrasas across the Indian subcontinent. And they are fighters and they are promoters of Sharia. Tablighi Jamaat itself has somewhere between 75 and 125 million members. It's known outside of America as the Army of Darkness.
So-called missionaries, but the mission that they're on is very much jihad. Phil, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is always a bracing conversation with you, and I'm very pleased to have it. I hope we'll have another one with you very soon. Come back to us, sir, if you would, in the near future. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.